From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with BlackAgendaReport.com columnist Danny Haifong about his recent piece that looks at whether the enemy of working people in the United States and elsewhere is capitalism, racism, and war, or is it Trump and Russia?
As you and all of your listeners may know, Donald Trump has been in the throes of a deep investigation that has led to multiple quote-unquote Russia trials held by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, which have basically accused him of wheeling and dealing with Russian President Vladimir Putin in sabotaging the elections. And this has been effective, at least on the Democratic Party voter side, where 60% now actually believe this madness when all evidence has pointed to the contrary. And what it really does, I think, this anti-Russia madness, this attempt to connect Trump to the Russia boogeyman, is a couple of things. One of them that isn't as apparent is the distraction that it serves from the broader crisis of capitalism and imperialism that's really wreaking havoc on the people in the United States, right? Whether that's the high levels of unemployment, where we see global unemployment remains 27 million higher than it was in 2007, whether it's the fact that Black Americans basically possess a net worth of zero in all across the United States, and in my home city, Boston, we see that, you know, 70% of the total prison population, which remains at 2.3 million, you know, is Black or Latino. Right. And we see that convictions for you know, life sentences have, you know, the time served for those convicted of life sentences in the 1980s are actually now 11 times longer. So we see this crisis of capitalism and imperialism in the United States being completely brushed over in the corporate media with this anti-Russia madness, but it also serves, you know, if we look at the capitalism and racism aspect of imperialism, we can also see that war is being completely drummed up,
right,
by this anti-Russia hysteria. And it's so apparent now that as Trump campaigned on the basis of a detente with Russia, as well as an end to regime change policy in Syria, we see after the recent strikes on Friday that it seems like this you know, this complete and utter war against Trump's rhetoric and Trump's policy proposals has had an effect, where, you know, now the corporate media is fawning over Donald Trump because he has done exactly, or has taken a step to do exactly what they have wanted all along.
Yeah, he blew something up. Now they love him. He blew something up.
Exactly. Thank you for going after President Bashar al-Assad. Thank you for now showing that you are the tough, you know, that you could be the tough imperialist president that we always wanted, because I don't think it's so apparent yet whether Donald Trump will continue in this path, given that further escalation in that region could lead to, you know, a nuclear proliferation that we haven't seen in world history, which... Right. I think would be a deep mistake for a Trump administration barely holding on to legitimacy as of right now.
Yeah, you know, let's start with the hearings themselves that have been moving this along. You know, one unusual aspect has been the attack on the people who conduct it, with the removal of Nunes, for example, and the a priori removal of Sessions. Forcing him to recuse himself from it, leaving an Obama appointee basically in charge at the department, at the Justice Department, and I call him the rank member rather than the ranking member, Schiff, more or less rolling the ball in the congressional efforts along with the Republicans in the other chamber. You know, so there's a whole legitimacy question facially there. I mean, it's like the prosecutor doesn't like the judge, and so, you know, it's usually difficult in a court to get a change of venue. It's certainly very difficult without a strong showing to get a judge removed and stay in the same venue, which is what we have here. That would be the analogy. So that's at the foundation of it. You have a unanimity of opinion on the legitimacy of the Syrian government across the Western media here, from Fox to Democracy Now, basically. Bashar al-Assad is a, you know, war criminal murderer, etc. And unfortunately, no evidence supports any of this. And you have even the United States doesn't recognize the government formally of Syria. They recognize like a Syrian version of the NTC that they used as a ploy for regime change in
the terrorist
in
council.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The National Terrorist Council. And you know, however, the United Nations seats the Syrian government, the one that was elected under a constitution that was adopted by referendum. A majority of all Syrians, including those living abroad, both voted in and for this constitution back in 2011, 2012, I don't remember, it was shortly after the war started. The legislature and the president elected in three elections that have taken place since then. That's the government that's seated at the United Nations, that whose deputy permanent representative spoke this past Wednesday and Friday at the Security Council, laying out in some considerable detail previous false flag and or outright use of chemical weapons by the U.S.-backed terrorists that are in Syria. None of this really gets any play in the media at all here, including the so-called progressive media. And that's at the foundation of the reporting now on this particular incident. And, of course, there's no evidence whatsoever of Russia hacking anything, other than maybe some Russian guy in a basement somewhere hacking somebody's credit card or whatever.
Exactly.
And we got guys right here in Austin working on the same thing, 17 years old, I'm sure. I dare say some kids up in Boston are doing that too.
I'm sure.
I don't think anybody's hacking nuclear codes or voting machines or anything up there, unless they're already in City Hall in Boston, for example, or working in some wards in Brooklyn or whatever here. So you've got like rigged processes, to use Trump's term of art, and people who were really pushing for regime change in Syria, in, again, with a unanimous consent and proselytizing of the media here, you know, no evidence supporting any of that, or supporting, of course, this claim that Russia has committed an act of war, which is what was voiced by some members of Congress, by hacking our election.
Right. Right, exactly. What we're seeing is a consolidation of imperialism in this time where there has been a rupture. And I think we missed a big opportunity here where we had someone in the White House who was deeply, deeply opposed and created such a division and such a conflict inside of the halls of Washington that ultimately, it took an all-out propaganda war to neutralize him, or to further move towards the neutralization of his administration. And that's that should be a very concerning thing for people in the United States, especially people in the United States who consider themselves on the left, who want to see a détente with Russia, who want to see peace in Syria, and who want to see ultimately a move towards a society in the United States that isn't dominated by the fact that six individuals, mostly U.S. capitalists, own more than half of the world's wealth, and ultimately loot the working class in order to enrich themselves. If we want to move towards a society where that's not the case, where we can have things like universal health care, free education, and an end to the ceaseless war that the U.S. government participates in, then we should have been ultimately focusing on this division and ultimately drawing out lines where we can both principally oppose Donald Trump, where we principally oppose him, on questions of immigration or what have you, but ultimately align with the positions that he ultimately staked out on an independent basis in order to differentiate himself and appeal to those who ultimately do not want to see their children go off into a nuclear war and get murdered on a mass basis. And that should have been, you know, that should have been paid attention to. So now we're seeing the consequences of that through all of these events that you had just stated, where the U.S. ruling class, the deep state especially, is on a roll to consolidate its power. And how far it will get remains to be seen. But I think what we are seeing is that it has been effective to a certain degree, especially this whole attack on Russia when it comes to the 2016 elections. That was a very strategic move and a very desperate move on the part of the deep state to create a narrative in the United States that could ultimately justify any number of actions on the part of the deep state. And we're seeing some of the consequences, I think, in Syria right now.
Yeah, you know, it may well be that there are, you know, a number of contradictions that sort of inhabit this entire moment. But conceding that as given for argument's sake, first of all, now when you talk about you know, what the deep state has done to constrain Trump, I mean, in essence, there is either a coup that's been accomplished or there's a coup that's still underway. And if you think about the objectives of a coup, it isn't necessary to, I mean, usually people conceive of it as a change in the identity of the occupant of a particular seat of power. But a coup can also be accomplished by leaving that person in and just usurping the powers, which is, you know, or forcing the hand of, you know, taking control of the strings of whatever, or just constraining the courses of action in a way that you get the desired outcome. In each case, you are removing the agency of someone with those powers to execute them in the way they want, and instead they're executed in the way that you want. And that is certainly underway if it hasn't been accomplished yet, and I want to get to that a little bit later. But the conditions are, you know, I was speaking with someone the other day, and I said, look, you know, this may be, and not to, you know, be, you know, to exaggerate or be alarmist, but this, we may have witnessed or be witnessing perhaps the largest error, you know, of epical proportion in our history, with the abandonment of the anti-war voters who voted for Trump on that basis. You had 65 million people voted for him. He continued throughout the campaign at some political cost. I mean, he had still has a firestorm of opposition across the media and across the establishment among the entire Democratic Party constituency, pretty much, including the so-called anti-war vote, and a lot of the Republican establishment over the promise, no regime change, no, not just Syria, he said no more regime change, it's bad policy, no more nation building, and no war with Russia, detente with Russia. There are, even if, you know, 65 million voters, even if it's because a lot of people say, well, it's only a small proportion, the rest of them voted for him because he's a racist. You know, I don't know how they calculate it, but 2% of 65 million is more than a million. It's 1.3 million. Okay, 20%. If only 20% of his voters voted on this key issue, the one I saw them give him a raving standing ovation over at the RNC. Okay, there's that sea of white Republicans. They weren't standing up for the Klan. They were standing up for no more regime change and no war with Russia. You know, the anti-war movement and the left have completely written off these millions of people who are motivated and activated on exactly their issue. And I just don't understand why even now, let's say that Trump is doing exactly what these people are accusing him of doing. He's actually changed course. Well, If you activate his voters, particularly with him being as vulnerable as he is, he still hasn't been able to establish a counter base, a constituency sizable enough to defend him against this ongoing coup. He can't afford to be writing off millions of people. You reach out to them and say, let's organize together, and we will either force Trump to do this, and we will also offer our support if he does what he promised. No, they're irredeemable racists. That's the response. And then I'm looking at, okay, how does the anti-war movement organize to stop war without these millions of people? You know, they had their rallies again Friday, Saturday. You know, 500 or 1,000 showed up here and there, as usual. What's their plan in the alternative to you know, organizing these people where they stand?
Exactly. No, there's no plan. I was at one of these protests, and unfortunately, there is no plan, because I think what we're seeing is such a crisis on the political level for the left that it's so apparent. History has been completely negated. And what I mean by that is, if we remember back in 2012 during those elections between Obama and Romney, I don't know if anyone watched those debates with any seriousness, but both candidates were completely and utterly in agreement about the policy direction of the U.S. imperialist system when it comes to war. Both of them were thumping their chests about, you know, stopping so-called Russia aggression. Both of them were thumping their chests about a broader war with Iran. And both of them were looking for regime change in Syria. Now, fast forward to 2016, where ultimately you had a candidate that represented that, Hillary Clinton. And then you had Sanders breaking from that foreign policy to a certain degree. Yeah, but then you had Trump, who completely trumped both of them on this question in terms of breaking with the consensus on regime change in Syria, Iran, Russia, and wherever around the world. So that wasn't paid attention to. People weren't looking at why that change had occurred. What were the conditions on the ground, both in the United States and around the world, that was creating a situation where, you know, regardless of what you think of Trump as an individual, regardless of what you think of Trump in terms of his overall position in this class order, we have to recognize that that rupture, that that break, even just rhetorically, represented something very, very big and much deeper than the individual himself. And I think, yes, it has been completely negated, this this obvious, almost obvious fact on the ground that, yes, there are millions of people, whether they are Trump supporters or whether they're just, you know, individuals, working class individuals living their lives, whether they voted for Trump or not. There was something to that position that he took, which obviously had a mass basis. And it's time to reconcile with that. And you know, we have a situation, I write in the article, where the historic leader of the anti-imperialist struggle, the Black Liberation Movement, is still in complete repair. So how do we move when we know that that movement, which ultimately in the past has been a bulwark of anti-imperialist struggle, is still, you know, is still trying to rebuild itself after, you know, a complete 8-year campaign of conservatizing the, you know, the Black voting bloc and the Black polity? We have to begin to, you know, organize against these wars now and find common, you know, find a common struggle between anyone who will oppose these wars. And that's something that is difficult, I think, for the left to reconcile, because there is this pressure, I feel like, this almost hysteric pressure to oppose anyone based on disagreement with anything. There's like a struggle for purity on the left rather than a struggle for some real material gains.
It's actually pseudo-purity, you know, because, for example, if you want to be, you know, a Marxist purist, one of the things you do is reject the great man theory of history and look at, you know, history as an unfolding of various social processes, economic and others, with economic processes and class dynamics being the primary motivator. So we're talking here not about whether or not Trump, the personality, is what we're supposed to address, but rather objective conditions, such as millions of people that are waiting to be organized into some useful action to forward the agenda that they demand, like let's not have a nuclear war. You know, you have Glenn Ford reporting for better than a year now on polls that show that black voters who have been for decades the strongest advocates of peace and the strongest opponents of war, having shifted their position over the life of the Obama administration, so that they may still be more anti-war than the aggregate average of the American population, but has moved towards the other pole considerably. And you've got this, you know, the spectacle that I witnessed at the RNC with the whole house, this basketball stadium, you know, the Cleveland Cavaliers Stadium is where they held it, whatever the hell they call the place. And, you know, it filled to capacity, including in the aisles, all of them standing up and wildly applauding when he said, no more regime change, no more nation building, no war with Russia. You know, this phenomena, we always think of the Republican convention as being a place where they say, you know, bonk, kill Russia, yeah, or whatever. No. And it was au contraire, exactly. You know, it was an entirely different condition. So you have all kinds of things that are like boiling in the body politic, you know, among the American population. And the anti-war movement, you know, they're printing up their signs and running out and saying the same thing, and they're assuming that, well, objective conditions will bring the people to us. They'll line up behind our working class program. And at the top of their sign, rather than saying, you know, looking at the reality of the political condition and putting up their, for example, Trump, you promised no war, deliver, or something like that, it's dump the Trump agenda. Now, part of the Trump agenda that they were marching under was no more regime change, no war with Russia, and they were saying dump the Trump agenda just like everybody else. Now, you had the Democrats in the street with that sign. A lot of them had hammers and sickles in Trump's name for letters. I can't even go there. And you have you know, underneath that, you know, Hillary for president in small letters or whatever crazy thing they had. And then, you know, the left with the same big letters, you know, dump the Trump agenda or whatever, and then socialism now. Or as if, well, the people are going to put on their reading glasses when the big moment comes, and they're going to parse those little lines there. That's what we want, socialism. Go line up behind that guy. I mean, it seems like an infantile fantasy is driving the strategy here. And I don't know how we get past that.
How we get past it? Well, we have to get to the point where we can reflect, self-criticize, and act in a different way, change our actions. And that's, you know, I think that's part of this whole crisis that the United States, the whole entire fabric of the United States has really come under, is all about. You know, this whole jingoism, this anti-Russia, anti-Syria narrative that has flooded the masses of the United States has really had a deep effect. It's almost a fear, and it was the same fear that occurred in the Obama administration, where most people who had the capacity to organize, you know, on the basis of anti-imperialism, were almost scared to speak out against war for the fear of offending the black American polity or what have you. And we see a similar dynamic going on right now, where there's almost an abhorrence to this idea that anyone who may harbor racist views, quote unquote, could be anti-war. And it's almost like a chest thumping against a segment of the population that voted for Trump, rather than a strategy towards building an anti-war movement that is capable of pressuring the U.S. state, you know, if we want to look at this beyond Trump, the U.S. state, from changing or at least attempting to reform its actions, which is the only way we can teach people on a mass basis whether that's possible or not. I say it's not possible. Yeah. But how are people going to really know that unless they engage in a struggle that can bring a material victory? And we know a material victory, especially around this question of war, and we know that that's the only way it's happened in the past when the U.S. imperialist system was engaged in war abroad, let's say in Vietnam. The only way people knew on a mass basis that war would, you know, could end was by engaging in a struggle to actually man something from an administration. And that was to, you know, end the Vietnam War. Then you had the end of the draft. Okay. How are we going to get to that point when we don't have those objective conditions working for us? Yeah. Well, we have to start building our subjective capacity to be prepared for that moment. And right now, when NATO is recruiting Russian speakers to play as extras in their war games, we have a lot of, unfortunately, infantile behavior going on within our ranks, and we have to really address that because the masses are struggling right now. We're in a complete crisis of imperialism of as you know, Tony Montero, and you always have epical
across
proportions.
The board. You know, and this is all taking place under the shadow of HUAC 2.0. I mean, you know, there's some real fear out there when people turn on their television and they see, you know, the kind of discussion going on at these hearings. You know, for me, for example, when you have Gene Shaheen saying that Russian propaganda kills, it has a body count, and you have Adam Schiff saying that you know, the election was hacked and it was an act of war, and then you have you know, that the hacking was done by RT, basically, somehow. You know, somebody like me that goes on RT, you know, I've pointed this out to several people already. I'm like a $4.75 cab ride from Sing Sing, where they executed the Rosenbergs. Okay, that wasn't for regime change here, which is what's alleged, and. You know, Lynn Stewart. We know Lynn Stewart, and she did a few years, more than a few, out of a 10-year sentence for holding a press conference. So, you know, what does enabling the hacking of our election on behalf of RT earn one as a sentence? You know, we're laboring under the shadow of this stuff, and, of course, the objective condition in reality is that NATO is in Lithuania, Poland, Norway, Ukraine. You got ships today, Sunday, steaming towards Korea, and this launch of weapons against Syria, all in play. Now, gratefully, there was a phone call in advance of the attack on the Syrian airbase to the Russians. There were no Russian casualties and very few Syrian casualties, which means that there was probably either a conference call or a follow-up call by Moscow to Damascus saying, okay, move your stuff out. And with the low number of casualties, I wouldn't be surprised if the casualties weren't Syrian Arab Republic Army folks or Air Force folks, but maybe some Al-Qaeda capturers or somebody lured into, hey, guys, we're going to get flown out of here over at so-and-so airport. Everybody meet there. and then setting up some Al-Qaeda people for this strike. Whatever it is, there are at least enough contradictions there to say, well, what we're looking at may be merely the apparent and not the material or the essential. And so perhaps Trump has been swung to the neocon or the R2P position, which he seems to be mouthing both. But maybe that's only apparent. And in fact, this is just a game that's being played out, a dance.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, we know that Trump has to remain in office, and we know that this anti-Russia
all we get is we get either Vice President Pence or Ryan, if they remove Trump, or some generals, which has been advocated by some, including some in foreign policy and other establishment places.
Oh, yeah, especially, you know, beating the drums of fascism when supposedly we have the fascist candidate in office already.
Dan, thank you very much. It's a pleasure, as always.
All right, pleasure. Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.